look, everybody's talking about GLP-1 weight loss medication right now. But what most people don't know is that getting started is so much easier than you may think. Most people assume it's hard to access or out of reach, but BreezeMed changes that. It's medically supervised weight loss that's completely online. No clinics, no referrals, no waiting rooms, just a licensed provider who handles everything.
It's efficient. You fill out a form in under 5 minutes, and if you qualify, medication is shipped directly to your door.
And these are licensed providers. It's medically supervised, and there are no hidden fees, especially with 20% off your first order. And with BreezeMeds, you can get started for $199 a month, and it ships to your door for free. No subscriptions, no lock-ins, and no hidden charges. Get 20% off your first order with code ATTWG at BreezeMeds.com. That's 20% off your first order, code ATTWG at BreezeMeds.com.
Darkcast Network. Indie pods with a dark side.
13-year-old Lee Ochi was left alone for an hour on the morning of August 27th, 1992. In that short window of time, something violent happened in her Tupelo, Mississippi home. Blood, hair, and clothing were all left behind, but Lee was gone. The remnants of Hurricane Andrew washed away potential clues, and no trace of Lee was found. Soon, the whispers started about someone close to Lee, her mother, Vicki Felton. But according to Vicki, there was someone else who police needed to look at. Lee's Sunday school teacher. Could a horrific crime committed 9 months after Lee's disappearance hold the answers in her case? When a person goes missing, there's a special kind of pain in the not knowing. I want to tell you the stories of those who never came home. Today, I want to tell you the story of Lee Ochi. I'm Kona Gallagher.
And I'm Ethan Flick.
And this is And Then They Were Gone. Welcome back, everyone.
Welcome back.
Thank you for joining us once again for part two. I'm Kona.
And I'm Ethan.
And we're the husband and wife team behind this podcast. Each week, I tell you the story of an unsolved missing persons case. Ethan doesn't know anything about the case going into the episode and is here to provide his reactions and questions in real time, hopefully asking some of the same ones you have at home. Now, if you haven't heard last week's episode, make sure you go and listen to that first. We talk about the full timeline of Lee's disappearance and her family dynamic. But just as a quick refresher, if it's been a week or whatever since you've listened to it, Lee Ochi had just turned 13 years old and lived with her mother, Vicki Felton, in Tupelo, Mississippi. Vicki and her second husband, Barney Yarborough, had recently separated, and on the morning of August 27th, 1992, Vicki had left for work and Lee was home alone. Lee and Vicki had had breakfast together, and Lee's grandmother was going to pick her up later and take her to an open house at her middle school. The tail end of Hurricane Andrew was heading toward Tupelo, however, and the weather was terrible. Vicki was concerned about Lee, so she called home twice, but didn't get an answer. She drove home only to find the garage door open and bloodstains throughout her house, some of which were still wet. Vicki called police around 9 a.m. to report her daughter missing. Lee had only been alone for an hour. Immediately, suspicion fell on Vicki's shoulders. There were rumors that Lee was being abused. Lee's stepfather had a solid alibi for that morning and passed a polygraph, but Vicki failed three. One administered by the Tupelo Police Department and two administered by the FBI. According to Lee's father, Donald Ochi, Vicki didn't call him to tell him Lee had gone missing until a day later. And even then, she didn't mention that blood was found. She told Don that Lee had run away. And it wasn't until days later, maybe even a week, that she finally said that blood had been found in the home. Now, I do want to talk about that, because I do question that aspect of Don's account. Tupelo police started investigating Lee's case right away, so it's a little hard for me to believe that he wouldn't have heard more details about Lee's disappearance from them.
Right. We don't know when they contacted him, but you would assume the crime scene itself indicates that obviously something violent happened.
Right.
Even before they type the blood, this is not a scene where they're like, oh, she ran away.
Yeah.
So they immediately start looking at suspects. And one big one would be an estranged father.
Exactly.
So
I have to imagine that they would have called him, maybe not that first day, because I think they were focused on
finding her,
yes. Right? Thinking she was near the house. Like, that was their focus. So I can absolutely see Vicky being the first one to tell him, maybe the next morning. But then I would think Tupelo police would have contacted him that day.
Probably.
Perhaps the day after, but not a whole week later
right.
Or whatever, right?
Yeah.
And I feel like they would have mentioned something, maybe not given him a ton of information because they're still trying to figure out, like, if he is a suspect, where he was, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
But, like, the idea that he didn't know about the blood for a week, I do question a bit. Now, you know, again, he didn't say that until 2017. Decades, 25 years, in fact,
yeah,
after
so
this all happened.
Timeline in his memory may have been a little skewed.
Right. And in 1998, which is still years later, but, you know, 6 years
closer.
As opposed to 25, he told a reporter that he believed Lee was dead from day one when Vicky told him that she was missing and he thought that she had been beaten to death in that house.
Right.
So those two things don't exactly line up to me.
Right.
I don't think that there's anything nefarious there. I just think that it's, you know, your thoughts, your perceptions, your memories, 6 years versus 25 years. And, you know, things shift. Like,
yeah.
It's not like facts just stay in a vault in your mind. Like, perceptions change.
Especially not around a traumatic event.
Exactly. Exactly. In any case, Vicky's behavior has definitely caused a cloud of suspicion to hang over her head for the last 34 years. Now, to my knowledge, Donald has never come out and specifically said that he believes his ex-wife killed his daughter, but it's pretty clear that he doesn't think it's outside of the realm of possibility. But as I mentioned at the end of last week's episode, Vicky has been saying for decades that there's someone out there who is a much better suspect than she is. So now, let's talk about Oscar McKinley Kearns, or Mike, as he was known. Mike Kearns was a cabinet maker and a Sunday school teacher at Holy Trinity Lutheran Church in Tupelo, the church that Lee and her mother attended. He also taught at the church's vacation Bible school. He knew Lee, and they shared a love of horses. Though reports differ as to how well they knew each other. Some people who attended the church said that they, like, interacted in group settings, you know, in Sunday school and vacation Bible school, but not on a one-on-one level and not outside the church. While other people have made it sound like they might have spent time together at horse stables, like doing things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I don't know which one is true. The other thing I'm not clear on because of differing reports is when his name first came up in Lee's case. He's never reported on in any of the early news articles, which doesn't mean he wasn't being looked at. But I do find it interesting that Vicky has openly and repeatedly said that she believes he's the one who took her daughter, but she wasn't saying that in the beginning when suspicion was falling on her. As I've mentioned, Vicky spoke to the press somewhat frequently in the early days, and she was considered the number one suspect, if not by police, then certainly by the town gossips. If she was concerned about this guy she went to church with, it seems to me that she would have brought this up publicly during that time. But, you know, that's just me. Now, there's also a possibility that Kearns was responsible for Lee's abduction and Vicky simply didn't see the warning signs, and that's why she didn't bring him up initially, because she didn't suspect him at the time. But timing is important. And the reason I'm bringing it up is because of what happened 9 months after Lee disappeared. Mike Kearns abducted a teenage girl. She was a ninth grader he knew through that same church that he attended with Lee and Vicky.
Right. So this is 9 months later.
Yeah. May of 1993.
But we don't know when exactly Vicky started pointing fingers at him.
Correct. There was nothing public, right? So I don't know if he was on her radar prior to this or if she heard about this and was like, wait a second.
It's the same Sunday school that Lee went to.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, people who suspect Vicky is responsible for Lee's disappearance believe that because this event happened, Mike did this, he became a convenient patsy. Because, yes, he is clearly a bad guy, but maybe it's just a coincidence that Vicky used to draw suspicion to someone else. And listen, maybe that's what happened. Maybe that's true. Based on what I had read online, when I was putting this original episode together, Mike Kearns was going to be a relatively small part of it. And that's why I said in last week's episode that I was like 80% done.
Yeah.
But then I found the court documents. And you all know I love a court document. And after spending time on the phone with three different courts in Mississippi and dealing with their awful court record website, that really makes me appreciate the one we have in Virginia, where I can look up
things anything
in the entire state.
Yes.
I don't have to go county by frickin' county.
Yeah.
I found enough that I wanted to give Oscar Mike Kearns his very own episode. So, but going forward in this, even though he went by Mike, I'm going to refer to him as Oscar because that's what's on all of these documents. And it just got confusing. Now, Oscar is mentioned in every write-up on Lee's case that you'll find, but there isn't a lot of depth to it. So here's the basic story that you will see everywhere. 9 months after Lee went missing, on May 6, 1993, Oscar drove to a 15-year-old girl's home in Memphis, Mississippi, under the pretext of driving her to school. Instead, he drove her to the woods where he raped her. The girl told police what happened to her, and Kearns was arrested. He pleaded guilty and was sentenced to 8 years in prison. He served less than four and was released in 1997. Within about 18 months of getting out, he committed another crime. Here's what the Daily Journal said in 2017. Quote, Oscar McKinley, Mike Kearns, is currently in the Mississippi State Penitentiary in Parchman after pleading guilty to kidnapping a Union County couple in 1999 and raping the wife, end quote.
Ooh, see, he's all over the place as far as age goes.
Right? Like, that seems crazy to
that's
me.
That's unusual for a rapist.
Exactly.
Like, they don't typically dip into pedophilia if they're into raping adults.
Right. And kidnapping a couple?
Yeah.
Like, that's a lot different from kidnapping a 15-year-old.
Right.
But that's basically all the details the articles have on Kearns. If you read any article on Lee, like, basically that's just what it says. So yes, it is extremely suspicious that this man who was the Sunday school teacher at the church Lee attended raped a teenage girl from that same church 9 months later. But I was skeptical. Assaulting a girl, then driving her to school where she could easily call police, is quite the de-escalation from the evidence of a bloody attack in Lee's house.
Right, but maybe Lee put up more of a fight and the head injury was not intended.
Well, yeah, and I do believe that.
And then he basically had to clean up after himself.
Right, but it is striking to me that, like, he commits this crime against Lee. It obviously got violent. And then he took her away from the house and she has not been found.
Mm-hmm.
And then 9 months later, instead of escalating, he tells this girl he's going to drive her to school, but instead takes her to the woods, rapes her, then drives her to school, and then just leaves.
Yeah, I mean, okay. I see what you're saying, but again, going back to it not being an intentional head injury and, you know, he doesn't want to get caught for murder. So he cleans up after himself there, but ultimately he's a rapist and wants to rape more.
Not Kilmore.
Not Kilmore.
Yeah.
Because then what happened to the couple? Did he kill either of them?
No, and I'll talk a little bit more about the couple here in a minute, because that was my question. Like, what about this couple? Like, what were the circumstances of that whole thing?
Yeah, and the connection and all.
Yeah, right? Like, who were they, you know? Were they also involved with the church? Like, how did that come about? So, yeah, so this whole thing made me want to see what else I could find out about Oscar Kearns. Because, like I said, I mean, that 1999 crime, I had a lot of questions. Like, what was going on here? So the first thing I did was try to find more information about that case in 1999, because that little blurb that I read you is all that any article said. And abducting a married couple is very different from either what he did to that girl in Memphis or what he potentially did to Lee. But I immediately hit a roadblock I couldn't find any record of Kearns pleading guilty to anything in 1999. I also searched newspaper archives and couldn't find a single article about a couple being kidnapped in Mississippi and the wife being raped. It seems to me that something like that would make the news, but the only results I found either in newspaper archives or just from online searches were only in articles about Lee. And there were only little blurbs just like that one. I never saw a single story about that event itself in either 1999 or 2000. And there were never any more details than what I just read to you. Now, something happened because Oscar Kearns absolutely went back to prison in 2000 and remained there until 2019. That's verified.
Right.
The other thing that is verified is his entry on the Mississippi State Sex Offender Registry. Like, that's an official document, right?
Now, do we know when he was registered as a sex offender? And was it 2000 or was it from when he raped the 15-year-old girl?
Both.
Okay.
So if you look him up on the State Sex Offender Registry, he has three offenses listed. The first one is from March 31st, 1994, and it says that his offense is statutory rape. Now, March 31st, 94 was the date of his conviction.
Statutory rape?
That part's weird because, I looked at the court document.
Statutory rape involves consent.
Right, and there was no consent, and he was not convicted of statutory rape. He pled guilty to rape.
Okay.
Period. So yeah, I don't know why it says statutory.
Okay.
That's actually kind of weird.
Yeah.
But the date matches up perfectly because March 31st was his date of conviction for that case. There are two other offenses listed, dated March 27th, 2000, which fits with a crime committed in 1999 and adjudicated in 2000.
Right.
But the actual offenses listed don't make sense with the story that's in the articles. They are rape and carnal knowledge of a child under 14 years of age and kidnapping if the victim was below the age of 18.
So it wasn't an adult.
That's what it sounds like.
Did he kidnap a whole fucking family and then rape the daughter?
No idea.
That doesn't make any sense.
But rape and carnal knowledge of a child under 14 certainly fits with what he did do in 1993 and what he potentially did to Lee.
Right.
And then my thought was, wait, is it possible that these were somehow all from that first case? And that maybe, like, he didn't have to register for the other offenses until 2000 when he went back to jail?
Maybe.
But if you go back to the entry, there's a location on it. And the 1994 one says DeSoto, Mississippi, which is where that crime took place. And the ones in 2000 say Union, Mississippi. So that doesn't sound like the same case to me. That doesn't sound like I had to register when I went back to jail for something I did in 1994 to this same person. It's two different counties.
I was thinking maybe if he goes back to jail in Union County, he then had to register with that county.
But it's a statewide database, you know?
Yeah.
So like why?
It would, yeah.
And let's not forget that his original victim was 15.
Right.
And this says under 14. But, you know, it also says statutory rape when it was rape. So maybe there could be some sort of mistake there. But I think, again, under the age of 14 and over the age of 14 are two different charges. Like, I think, like, that's actually a very important distinction legally.
Yeah.
So I don't know that that would be just like a simple clerical error.
Yeah, this doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't make any sense. And this is why the episode's late. This is why it's two parts. Because this wasn't making any sense. So I searched Union County's records. Because that's what the registry says, that in 2000, he had to register because of an offense in Union County. I couldn't find anything in Union County with Oscar Kearns' name on it. Not a thing. I even called all three courts in the county in hopes of getting a case number, thinking that maybe I was just having an issue with the name, you know, whatever.
Right.
They couldn't find anything either. I talked to three clerks in three courts. Nobody could find it. I was, however, able to find the court record on his first abduction in DeSoto County, and I found a lot of interesting details inside, many of which seem incredibly relevant to Lee's case. Does anyone else feel like August is the Sunday of summer? It's the perfect time to hit reset before the autumn rush, and for me, that always starts with my wardrobe. Quince proves that you don't need a crowded closet to look incredible. You just need the right pieces, and I just bought a couple of great ones from Quince. I got this beautiful ribbed elbow-length shirt that will transition from summer to fall, and even though it's basically a short-sleeve t-shirt, it looks super elevated. And it certainly helps that everything at Quince is priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And I love that they work directly with ethical factories and they cut out the middleman. So you're paying for quality, not brand markup. So upgrade your everyday. Download the Quince app for app exclusive offers or go to quince.com/ATTWG. Get free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada and the UK too. That's quince.com/ATTWG. You know, I love a good mystery, but not when it comes to what's going on with my body. Yet even when I go to the doctor, it seems like I still don't get the answers I'm looking for. Most people who get blood work done hit the same wall. The results come back, they get a nod, and everything looks fine, and they're sent on their way. Jevity is the first all-in-one precision health membership that closes that gap. Your membership includes access to a functional health expert and longevity clinician who review your blood work and build a personalized protocol. Jevity sent a phlebotomist to my house to take my blood, and they tested everything from cholesterol, blood pressure, to my cortisol levels and my thyroid. They even do a gut microbiome analysis. Jevity gives you a personalized plan, so 93% of members see meaningful improvement from their first to second round of blood work. And we have an exclusive offer for our listeners who want to try it for themselves. Go to gojevity.com/gone and use promo code ATTWG for 20% off your purchase. That's gojevity.com/gone and use promo code ATTWG for 20% off your purchase. I'm really excited to tell you, we've got another banger from Kensington Publishing and author Noelle W. Eiley, who wrote Ask for Andrea. Her new book, Gray After Dark, is incredible. It's a thriller that's inspired by a real crime, the 1984 abduction of Olympic biathlete Carrie Swenson, who was kidnapped and left stranded in the wilderness by her attackers. The story follows Miley, an injured Olympic hopeful who's spending the summer training in Idaho's remote Frank Church wilderness when she's abducted during a morning run. Suddenly, she's trapped in an off-grid cabin, miles from help, forced to rely on her athletic training, instincts, and sheer determination to stay alive. This book doesn't come out till June 30th, but I was so excited to get an early copy. And what I loved is it's not just a thriller about escaping a captor. It's also a battle against wilderness itself. Miley's stuck in the woods and realizing that surviving one more day is far from guaranteed. So if you're a fan of Freda McFadden, Karen Slaughter, John Mars, or true crime stories, Gray After Dark absolutely deserves a spot on your list. As I mentioned, Oscar Kearns went to the girl's house under the guise of driving her to school. And that's what's mentioned in all the articles about Lee. But I learned a lot more details. So he drove to her house, but he ended up taking her to a nearby Days Inn and tried to sexually assault her. Apparently what happened was he took her to the Days Inn under a pretext of like he needed to take some measurements because, you know, he was a cabinet maker. And I think he was like going to be telling her he was like going to be redoing some of the rooms or, you know, whatever. Right. So he's like, yeah, just come with me to the hotel. Let me take these measurements. Then I'll take you to school. So we got her in the room, tried to sexually assault her and was like, hey, if you don't do what I want you to do, I'm going to call your parents and I'm going to tell them that you're a whore, you know, like whatever, right? And she's like, call my dad. She's like, I don't even know his work number, but call him. I don't care. And so he was like kind of taken aback by it and like bailed kind of and was like, you know what? Yeah, you're right. I'm sorry. Let's just get back in the car. I'll drive you to school now. So he gets her back in the car, doesn't drive her to school. He drives her to a wooded area. And she's like, yeah, he kept on driving. And I was like, where are you going? This isn't the right way. You know, whatever, whatever. Kept on making excuses. Drove her to the woods. At which point, he took a knife out and threatened her. So he parked, he pulled out a knife from the underneath the armrest of the car is what she said. He told her to get out of the car and then made her undress him and then undress herself and lie on her clothes while he raped her. He then took her back home, made her change her clothes, and then drove her to school. Now, the two details about the knife and changing the clothes
match with the evidence that we have in Lee's case.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't have any evidence of a knife being used in Lee's case.
No, but it makes sense.
Yes.
It makes sense that he was threatening her with a knife. And that's how this whole thing started. The girl made a full statement to police about what happened that day. And, you know, I'm not going to go into most of it. But this section feels potentially relevant. Quote, he started poking at my leg with it, the knife, and he told me to get out on the driver's side. I said, I didn't want to go. He said, do you want me to hit you? I said, no. And he said, well, I'm going to if you don't get out. And he forced me out on the driver's side. He made me walk. He was poking the knife in my back, end quote. She also said that at one point, he grabbed her by the neck and threw her. If he grabbed Lee by the neck and threw her, that could account for the blood and hair on the doorway.
Right.
Police also said at the beginning of Lee's investigation that the height of that blood stain coincided with somebody who is about 5 feet tall. Lee was 4'10". So what I immediately pictured before I even knew about this was somebody picking Lee up by the neck, lifting her up, and slamming her into the doorway.
Yeah.
So that's always what I had pictured in my head. And then I read this. When this girl says that Kearns grabbed her by the neck and threw her. Like,
yeah. It's his MO. The only difference is here it's in an open field versus in a house where there's obstacles.
And rooms to run into and, you know, doors to slam and things like that. Yeah. And what's important about this is that it answered one of the big questions I had about the attack that he was convicted for, which was there violence involved? And I mean, obviously, listen, a rape is violent. But what I mean is, did he beat her? Did he hit her? You know, was there something like that? Because obviously there was a violent struggle in Lee's case.
Right.
And while this incident didn't result in the same violence, it could have. Like, you know, he threatened her with that type of violence.
Right.
Some other interesting information from the victim's statement is that she was asked by the investigator if Kearns had ever made sexual advances toward her or any other girls that she knew of prior to this assault. She said no. Now, this is especially relevant because she had known Kearns for the majority of her life. She was 15 at the time of this attack and said she had known him for 13 years. 13 years, and she had never seen a red flag from this guy up until the day he attacked her. And it sounds as though she didn't have much or even any contact with Kearns outside of church, so it doesn't seem like a grooming situation either. She told the officer that Kearns had gotten her phone number and address from her friend who she went to church with. Kearns also asked the friend about all of the victim's background information, family, friends, things like that. So, like, he didn't already have that information. He hadn't been forming a relationship with this girl over the years.
Right.
He fixated on her.
Yeah.
And attacked her. And it makes me wonder
if the same thing happened to Lee.
Yeah. And if he had ever asked anybody about her. Kearns also didn't just show up at her house that morning to drive her to school. Like, that wasn't a thing that he did, right? He had actually called her earlier that morning And he said that he had overheard her and her friend talking about family problems that the victim had been having. He wanted to come over and talk to her about that. So that's how this started. He didn't normally drive her to school. They didn't have that type of relationship. To her, this was her nice, concerned Sunday school teacher who was worried about her home life. She told him that he could come over and that basically they could talk and he could just drive her to school, you know, because she was like in the middle of getting ready for school.
Yeah.
And so she's like, yeah, sure. Like, we can talk about it. If you want to give me a ride, we can do that. And as we talked about in part one, Lee was also having family problems. Could he have weaseled his way into her life the same way? Did he target girls who seemed vulnerable, who seemed like they didn't have a good family life, who didn't seem like they had strong parental support?
Yeah, I mean, this all fits. The two crimes are almost identical, with the exception of, obviously, Lee's went south.
Yeah. In a way that it doesn't seem like he was expecting it to.
Right.
This girl who he attacked says that she had known Kearns for basically her entire life and that he had never made any advances toward her. So if he was involved with Lee's disappearance, it would absolutely make sense that Vicky didn't see any red flags and wouldn't have thought to bring him up to police when Lee initially went missing.
Right. Because he was just the Sunday school teacher.
Yeah. And he had never been creepy. Nobody had ever complained about him. Like, he was a good guy. Everybody liked him. Like, he wasn't off grooming kids. He wasn't off, like, buying them little presents and trying to get them alone. Like, none of that. He just apparently became fixated and decided to attack. Now, I would kill to see the phone records in Lee's case. Did a call come in from Oscar Kearns that morning? And, you know, also...
Or from a Holiday Inn.
Well, yeah, or Days Inn. But yeah, Days Inn. Right? Did Vicky actually call like she said she did, you know? Were there any outgoing calls from Lee that morning that would prove that she was alive that morning and not killed the night before, as some people believe, you know?
Right.
Like, and obviously, like, police, I'm sure, have all of this, but like...
But we don't have
it. We don't have it, and yeah. I want it. I want to know. Kearns' victim also made a victim impact statement via a written form, and that form is in her records. On that form, there's a place for additional concerns. And this next part blew my mind. She wrote, quote, "I have recently learned that this man has raped other girls after me. Will he be trialed at the same time for these charges when he is trialed for the ones he committed against me?" End quote.
After her.
After her. Her attack happened in May 1993. This statement was written in October of that year. Kearns was arrested and released on a $30,000 bond pretty quickly after the assault. So is she saying that he was raping girls while he was out on bond?
Seems like it.
Yeah, it does. Because on November 10th, 1993, just days or weeks after she wrote that statement, a motion was filed to revoke Kearns' bail. In it, it says, quote, "In Pontotoc County, Mississippi, on or about October 7, 1993, the defendant is charged with committing the crimes of rape and aggravated assault. The defendant was released in that jurisdiction upon bail in the sum of $30,000. End quote. Which, how do you get arrested for a rape while you're out on bail for another rape and still get bail? Like, what?
I mean, the only thing that I can think of is that they didn't know about the first case because it hadn't been adjudicated. But he would, and it's 1994.
Yeah, and it's a different county.
And it's a different county.
We end of 1993, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we don't know what type of communication existed between courts and counties back then.
Yeah.
It's, you know, I mean, yes, the internet existed, but barely. And
even now, like I said, when you look people up, you have to do it county by county.
Right.
And that's on the public facing site, you know, of course, it's different, sure. But still.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. But that.
And the bond was the same in both. So my assumption would be that a person with no priors, given this type of crime, would have a designated set
bond amount
of
yeah.
bond. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know.
It's still fucking crazy. Don't get me wrong.
Yes. And I've never seen that mentioned anywhere in anything I've read about Lee.
Right.
But what's insane is that motion to rescind his bond was denied on November 17th. And Kearns remained out on bond.
Why? Like, what?
I don't know. The order that's in the documents was just very, like, boilerplate. And it was like, yeah, we find insufficient evidence to revoke bond, basically.
What the fuck?
Isn't that wild? So then I went back to the Mississippi State Court online case thingy and looked up Pontotoc County. Couldn't find a single thing with Kearns' name on it. Couldn't find a single newspaper article about any rape that occurred.
So what the hell happened to the case?
I have no idea. I don't know what the case was. I don't know who it involved. I don't know what happened to it. I couldn't find anything in the newspapers or the courts.
That's just, that's wild.
Do you see why I was struggling? As I dug deeper into the documents of this case, I found another piece of evidence that could be relevant to Lee's case. Oscar Kearns' blood type is O.
Get the fuck out. Really?
Yep. Because they took samples from him because his victim did a rape kit. Now, at the time in Mississippi, they weren't doing DNA testing. They were still doing blood type testing
right.
for rape kits. But they had semen from his victim, and they found out that he was that semen belonged to somebody who was type O, and Oscar Kearns is a type O secretor. So there's a possibility that the blood samples taken from the scene, from Lee's scene, didn't actually all belong to Lee. And again, we talked in part one, I don't know what blood type Vicky is. Vicky could also be O, but she could potentially be A or B.
Right.
But if my earlier theory is correct about the bathroom cleanup being because of a wound the perpetrator sustained, it should be noted that no one reported seeing any wounds on Vicky. Also, even if at the time during his panic, Oscar was thinking, I need to clean up my blood, so I'm not leaving it behind, he wouldn't have known what blood type Lee was.
Right.
He wouldn't have known that they had the same blood type, so police wouldn't know that it wasn't hers. He's just thinking, shit, I've got to clean up my blood.
Yeah.
But he could have left other blood behind and the police just didn't know because the testing wasn't there.
Or he could have been cleaning himself up after raping her and he wasn't worried about the rest of the blood in the house.
Yeah, that's true, too. So we do know it was blood that was cleaned up on the bathroom counter because that's what police said. They said it was like a pink sheen mm-hmm. on the counter from blood that had been wiped up. But yeah, you're absolutely right. He could have been cleaning up after a rape as well.
So my question now is, and this you probably nobody knows other than the police in those two separate counties, is any of the evidence still preserved?
In Lee's case?
In either case. We know that they did a rape kit for the 93 rape. So mm-hmm. they have his blood type or sample
right.
in that case.
Yeah.
Is there any evidence preserved in Lee's case that they could potentially compare the two?
So the answer to the Lee question is maybe. I think the issue is that, yes, there is evidence preserved. The question is how much and right. how viable is it? Because right. they've tried to do various testing over the years. And the issue with earlier forensic testing is that it used large samples.
Mm.
So I am not sure
what's
left after that, yeah. basically. But I think that is still a possibility that we could get testing. In terms of samples from Oscar, like, yes, we know his blood type, obviously. I don't know if any DNA samples exist of him.
From that rape kit.
Yeah, I would imagine probably not, because that case was adjudicated. Like, I would imagine that evidence was probably destroyed after a certain point. What I don't know is if, because he ended up going back to jail and was in prison up until 2019, I don't know if they ever took his DNA.
And put it into CODIS.
Right.
Yeah.
So potentially. After the forensic tests came back in the rape case, Kearns changed his plea to guilty. His sentence wasn't 8 years, as is generally reported. It was actually 24 years, with 16 suspended. He was only convicted of the rape charge. Two additional charges for kidnapping and sexual battery were dropped. Now, you mentioned, you know, the bond about whether or not this was his first offense. It actually wasn't. It's his first sexual or violent offense, but it was his second felony. He was also convicted of grand larceny in 1981. Oscar Kearns was sent to prison on April 4th, 1994. He was released on October 6th, 1997. Now, this part you do know a little bit about already, because while I was working on this, your parents came into town and your father spent 37 years as a state parole agent. So I was still trying to figure out what got Oscar Kearns sent back to jail in 2000. I had started to kind of get an idea, so I ran it by your dad to see if, like, what I was thinking even made sense. And he did confirm what I had been thinking, that the suspended sentence can perhaps explain why I couldn't find any information on the case that sent Kearns back to jail in 2000. That article from 2017 says that he pleaded guilty to kidnapping a Union County couple and raping the wife in 1999. But remember, his sex offender registry has him raping a child under the age of 14. Now, I still don't know what the hell happened in 1999. I don't know if we...
Yeah, because that still doesn't fit with the previous crime.
Like, none of any of that makes sense. Like, I don't know who his victim was, if it was a child, if it was, you know, a wife, like the article says, like, what the hell was happening? But something happened in 1999. And whatever it was, I'm wondering if it was all dropped in favor of him just being sent back to prison to serve the rest of his original sentence, saving the victim or victims the trauma of a trial. His 15-year-old victim underwent a rape kit, multiple invasive police interviews, and was going to have to testify at a trial, as were her friends. So they had a witness list in the documents, and like her friend from church was on there. Her friend who she talked to at school and had her call the police was on there. Like, this trial was going to be awful for a lot of people.
Yeah.
The victim herself would have had to testify. Kearns's guilty plea meant that she at least didn't have to do that, but the trade-off was that he went from facing a potential life sentence on three charges to being convicted of only one and receiving all but 8 years of a sentence suspended before being paroled after three. I can absolutely see another victim looking at that and going, hey, why don't we just not do that at all and send him back to serve his original sentence?
Or the DA would be the one suggesting that.
Well,
to
exactly.
The victim, to save the victim.
Right. Like, the DA would present that to the victim and say, hey,
you won't have to go through any of this.
Yeah.
Because we already got him on this.
And he will go back to jail for a good amount of time.
We can revoke his parole on this sentence and he goes back to jail.
Right.
And you don't have to go through anything.
Yeah. And your father was a hearing examiner at one point, and he was telling me that, like, generally that all happened in the jail, mm-hmm. in the prison, you know, wherever it was.
During the hearing.
It didn't happen in open court, so there wouldn't be court records for me to find on this.
Right.
So, like, that does kind of fit with, like, why there's no trace of, like, his crime that sent him back to prison. And so because he committed some heinous crime while on parole, it meant that he spent the next 19 years in prison, which again, from the victim's perspective, I get making that decision, you know, gamble with, yeah, maybe he would get longer than 19 years, but he could get a lot less too.
Right.
I mean, hell, they didn't even revoke his bail
before
when he was accused of rape, you know? Kearns was eventually released in 2019. Officers attempted to interview him about Leochi over the years, but he always refused to talk. At one point, though, he did say he would take a polygraph, but his attorney nixed that idea. In the end, he never answered a single question about Lee's disappearance. And Oscar Kearns died in 2021 at the age of 63, just 2 years after his release.
Good fucking riddance.
Right? Now, his wife.
His wife?
He was married.
The whole time?
Not the whole time, but for a lot of it, she stood by him through the first conviction, but ended up divorcing him around the time he was sent back. And I only know that because when I was like trying to find all these different like crimes in different counties, I found the divorce.
Court records
for
that? Yeah. Jesus.
And I want to say it was like 1999 or 2000. Now, this next part really isn't completely irrelevant, but like I couldn't leave it out of this episode because I came across his obituary from 2021 and it's insane. Here's an excerpt. Quote, "A native of Santa Paula, California, Mr. Kearns had been a resident of North Mississippi for the past 45 years.
Resident of the state for 19 of those 45 right. years.
A total of like 22 because of the original three.
Yeah.
He was employed in the cabinet manufacturing industry for most of his life before retiring 2 years ago. So I guess he was making cabinets in prison too.
I guess that's a job in prison. Yeah.
And in 2019, you know, it was like, I think I'm going to retire.
Yeah.
A Christian and devoted member of the apostolic faith, Mr. Kearns will be remembered as a person who loved his church and his family. Fishing, horseback riding, and caring for his pets brought him much pleasure." End quote.
Forgot to add raping little girls in like, that obituary.
Like, that is some whitewashing.
Yeah.
Like,
shit.
Holy shit.
Wow.
Oscar Mike Kearns was an evil man, and now he's dead. The only bad thing about that is the fact that if he knew anything about what happened to Leochi, that information likely died with him. The teenage girl Kearns was convicted of raping was close to the same age as Lee. He knew her from the same place, and he abducted her early in the morning by driving to her house. The similarities are striking, to say the least. And he had type O blood, which is the only type of blood that was found at the scene. And this, okay, this is, I was almost going to talk about this in the first episode, but like I wanted to save it for this part when we were actually talking about Mike, because when we were talking about the garage and the garage door being opened and wanting to see the phone records, it really makes me wonder if he called Lee that morning. And if he did he say, hey, I'll come over, we can talk about your family, your problems, your stepfather, like whatever. It's pouring outside. Can you open the garage door for me so I can pull in?
Yeah, that would make sense as to why the garage door was open.
And
why she would let him in.
Yep.
And the difference between that one and the following one, at least the following one that he was arrested for, is that I think after the horribleness that he inflicted on Lee, I think Lee tried to run. I think Lee fought back and tried to leave. And I think the only reason why Lee felt that she could do that was because she was home, not in an empty field. The similarities are striking. And rapists tend to be ritualistic because it's part of the whole thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So a knife pushing her, forcing her to undress. Then he goes and cleans himself off.
Yeah.
And then she had already redressed, and she tried to make a run for it, knowing that there were neighbors around. And that's when it went really wrong. And then he grabs the sleeping bag, rolls her up, puts her in his car.
I think that makes sense. I think the rape would have occurred while she was still wearing the nightgown. Some amount of violence obviously happened while she was still in that nightgown.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, afterwards made her redress, just like he did with the 15-year-old. And because it was her redressing herself, automatically put her dirty clothes in the hamper.
She puts her glasses on.
Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, you're right, tried to make a run for it, tried to
fight back somehow.
Yeah. And then things escalated. Because while we do know that there was blood on the nightgown, and we know that her new outfit was missing, we don't know if there was blood on the new outfit, you know. Right. We don't know anything about that, right?
Yeah. And again, the only reason why the second victim didn't make a run for it...
Well, she was in the middle of nowhere.
She was in a field.
Yeah, where was she going to go?
Exactly. Because she did put up a fight, or at least a resistance, some resistance at the hotel.
She did.
And that's when he went to plan B and took her to an open field where nobody could hear her scream and yeah. She couldn't run
And that's
away.
When he brought out the knife.
Right.
He didn't have the knife in the hotel.
Right.
And that actually kind of makes sense too, because if he was so freaked out about what happened to Lee, I can understand him just trying to coerce her into having sex with him and not wanting to bring the knife and not wanting things to get out of hand like they did.
Right.
And then realizing, okay, this isn't going to work, but also I can't have what happened with Lee happen in this hotel room.
Yeah. Where other people will hear it.
Yeah. And that has my name on it.
Right.
Because that's one of the things that corroborated her story is he had the Days Inn receipt in his car. You know, he was tied to that hotel room. And so, yeah, he went to plan B, which is take her out to the middle of nowhere where she can't escape, where there aren't walls, where there isn't evidence that can be left behind. Now we can get the knife.
Right.
And hopefully she'll just comply because, like you were saying, murder wasn't his primary goal. It wasn't what he wanted to happen.
No, it was the rape.
Yeah.
And in Lee's case, I'm almost 98% sure Lee was not his first victim. It's too calculated to be a first-time offense. There's probably a lot of victims out there before Lee, and there clearly are victims out there after the second victim.
Like, it seems like he could not stop himself.
He's a serial rapist.
And was completely out of control by that point.
Yeah. I mean, it's the same as a serial killer.
Yeah.
It's the same type of mentality. The difference is the crimes are different. One kills, one rapes.
Right. I mean, he was accused of committing another rape while he was out on bond awaiting trial for this attack on this 15-year-old. And then was accused again while he was out on parole for that attack after serving 3.5 years in prison. Like, he had gotten caught and served 3.5 years in prison and still couldn't control himself. You know, potentially he managed to control it for 18 months, but that was it.
I think if I were a cold case detective on Lee's case or involved in any way in her case, I would really try to test whatever evidence is left, if it's even possible, against his DNA. Or even if you don't do it for Lee's case, see if his DNA is in CODIS. And if it's not, try to get it entered and see how many matches there are.
Dig his ass up if you need to.
Yeah.
Because I think, yeah. It seems like there might be something else out there. It is interesting because, again, you look at this case, there are two names that pop up. It's Oscar Kearns, Vicki Felton. Now, DNA testing would be a lot harder to rule Vicki out.
Right.
Right? because, okay, you find her DNA on Lee's clothes. Like, what does that prove?
That doesn't prove anything. That's, that's her mom.
Exactly. But there's no earthly reason why this guy's DNA should be on anything.
Exactly.
So that would be very strong evidence that it's him.
Now, even if you do that, let's say best case scenario, you do that and you get a match. And now we know that he was involved. It's still not going to bring Lee home because he's dead.
Right. So we would have no idea what he did with her.
Right. But maybe there's things in his case file that we aren't aware of that could narrow down a search area.
Right. Yeah. I mean, we don't know if he owned other properties or, you know, any of that. Right. Or if his family did or what. He never answered any questions about Lee, so we have no idea what he was doing on August 27th, what his alibi would have been had anybody ever asked. We don't know where he was supposed to be that morning. We don't know where he was supposed to be that afternoon, the night, the next day. We don't know any of it because he wasn't on the radar that day. And in everybody's defense, it truly seems like there is no reason he would have been.
Right.
Now, there are a few more things about Lee's case that I do want to make sure we talk about. And that's getting back to Vicky, right? And the idea that Lee could have potentially been killed the night before. Because that, you know, again, that was my very first thought when I was reading about this.
Well, yeah.
And like the tight timeline and like her coming back and discovering it, I was like, well, she's been dead, you know? But then you read about the wet blood. Now, another thing that I read, the wet blood has been said by police officers. So I'm going to say
that wasn't even Vicky saying the blood was still wet.
No, the police
said the blood was still
wet. So I consider that to be confirmed.
Yeah.
One thing that I have also seen that I do not consider to be confirmed, but I consider to be interesting, is that there is a report that Lee called one of her girlfriends at around 8 a.m. on the morning of her disappearance. So like right after Vicky left for work.
Yeah.
Because she was freaked out about the storm. And so, allegedly, she called one of her friends and spoke with her on the phone. So if that's true, it makes Vicky an even more unlikely suspect. So if Lee was alive at 8 a.m., that means that Vicky would have had to come home, kill her daughter, partially clean up in the bathroom, put the clothes in the hamper, hide her daughter's body in about a half an hour?
Yeah. I mean, plus it's also probably safe to assume since the police looked into her alibi that they were able to alibi the timeline of when she left work. So it would...
Right. Because, you know, police have never said like, oh, and also she failed three polygraphs and she wasn't at work.
Right.
Or she failed three polygraphs and she never actually called home. You know, like that.
It corroborated parts of it.
That's what it seems like. Yeah. Yeah. But with all of that said, with knowing all of this, you know, we have that quote from Chief Aguirre from 2017 saying that they couldn't completely rule Vicky out, that it was weird that she left and then immediately called to check on Lee and went back to the house and she failed three polygraphs. And like, there's a lot of stuff that doesn't match up. Right.
Right.
And on January 29th, 2025, federal and state agents showed up at Honey Locust Drive. WTVA reported that agents from the FBI and the Mississippi Bureau of Investigation brought in canine units and were digging in and around the drainage ditch that runs along the end of the cul-de-sac. WCBI reported that a backhoe pulled rocks out of that ditch with Tupelo Public Works crews assisting. Mississippi State University's forensic anthropology team spent more than 12 hours on site. The MBI's cold case unit confirmed that the search was part of the Ochi investigation and said, of course, that findings couldn't be disclosed. The current homeowners, who bought the house in 2009, told WCBI what prompted the search. A new investigator had come onto the case, developed leads, and brought in equipment that had never been used before. So they obviously had to give permission to have them come on their property, which they're like, yeah, we actually had no idea about any of this. We've lived here since 2009 and didn't know when we bought it, but they did give permission. Then in May 2025, the MST forensic anthropologist who worked the search, Dr. Jesse Goliath, said something to WTVA that maybe he wasn't supposed to say. Investigators still believe that Lee's remains are on or near the property where she lived. Not in a distant county, not carried off down the interstate somewhere, but right where she went missing. The working theory of the people digging is that Lee never left Honey Locust Drive at all.
Now, to be fair, if her remains were found there, that still doesn't mean that Vicky was the killer.
It doesn't. I mean, because Oscar Kearns could have left Lee's body near her house. He didn't seem particularly adept at hiding his crimes. He could have panicked, put her somewhere nearby, and then the storms took care of the rest. But Vicky could have done the same thing.
She could have.
There are so many things that we just don't know about this case, and we're simply missing the pieces we need in order to put the puzzle together. But as I've looked into this, and especially after what I've now learned about Oscar Kearns, I feel like the answers are there, like they're within reach. Now, back to your question about the remaining evidence, there has been talk of additional forensic testing on the evidence that does still exist in the case. If that's possible, and like we said, if his DNA is anywhere on any of that evidence, I mean, that tells you what happened right there. But, you know, there's also another possibility, right? Because his wife stuck with him through that first conviction for years, right? But then did eventually divorce him. Maybe she has information. Maybe she has information that she wasn't willing to share when all this went down.
And they just haven't looked into her or too much into him.
Yeah, and I don't know for sure if she's still alive. I haven't found any evidence that she's not. But if she is and she's out there, maybe she does know something, or maybe she can at least give information that might point detectives in the right direction. You know, maybe she doesn't, like, he didn't confess to her. She doesn't actually know anything about this.
It could be the opposite. She could very easily alibi him, like, legitimately.
Yeah.
And then that's ruled out.
Right. Maybe they were out of town on August 27th, 1992.
Yeah.
You know, they could have been on vacation. Who knows?
Right.
Or she could be like, oh, yeah, he actually had a hunting cabin up in, you know, wherever, like, that yeah. Nobody knew about.
Right.
Oh, and listen, this is already long, but Mississippi kills me. So part of the documents when he pleaded guilty to that rape, it was a couple weeks before his trial was supposed to start. So it was like the end of March, his trial was supposed to start mid-April. He goes in instead, works out a deal, gets two of the charges dropped, ends up pleading guilty to rape, gets a suspended sentence, blah, blah, blah. So when you plead guilty, you have to have a hearing in front of the judge, because the judge doesn't necessarily have to accept your plea.
Right.
He has to, one, believe that, you know, you're making it of your own free will, you're not coerced into it, that you understand the terms of the plea, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. So they go through all this. The judge is asking him questions, and this fucking guy gets up and talks about why he's pleading guilty. And he's like, well, you know, there's actually a lot more to this story. Because, like, part of it is the DA gives the basic facts of the case and the basic evidence that they have against him.
Yeah.
And so he gets a chance to speak, and he's like, well, you know, there's really a lot more to it that we don't really need to get into. A lot of, you know, extenuating circumstances. But the point is that I believe that it's going to be easier on the girl's family and easier on my family if I just plead guilty.
What a fucking piece of shit.
And then at the end of it, his lawyer... And listen, I don't fault his lawyer for this. His lawyer's doing what he's supposed to do. I fault the fucking system for being this insane. His lawyer goes, hey, So my client's out on bond. His trial isn't supposed to be for a couple weeks. So he was going to be free for those couple weeks. So this is a Friday that this hearing is happening. He's like, how about instead of you remanding my client to jail today, you give him the weekend because he's got a lot of plans. It's Easter weekend. He has a family reunion scheduled for Sunday that he'd like to attend. And it's his and his wife's wedding anniversary on Saturday. So how about we come back on Monday and he turns himself in then? So he could celebrate his wedding anniversary before
he goes to jail for
raping a fucking child.
Did the judge let him do it?
Yep.
Oh, my God.
That's why his conviction was on April 4th. Because he went to jail on April 4th after pleading guilty on March 30th or 31st.
Unfucking believable.
So anyway, yeah, he's dead. Good. Vicky moved out of Mississippi after her daughter's disappearance because, like I said, people kept on talking around town, you know? She now lives in Michigan. She has stopped accepting interview requests and had Lee declared legally dead in 2024. Donald Ochey signed off on that petition. Lee Ochey celebrated her 13th birthday less than a week before she went missing. She would be turning 47 this summer. The kids at that school open house she never made it to are middle-aged now. They've had 34 years of first days of school and graduations in their own kids' open houses. The house on Honey Locust Drive has had another family living in it longer than Lee's family ever lived there. Regardless of who is responsible for what happened to Lee Ochey, she deserved to live all of the days between 13 and now, the good ones and the bad ones. Failing that, she deserves to be remembered. Lee Ochey has been missing from Tupelo, Mississippi since August 27th, 1992. She's a white female with blonde hair and hazel eyes. At the time of her disappearance, she was 4 foot 10 inches tall and weighed approximately 95 pounds. She has a strawberry birthmark at the base of her skull, small scars on her right leg, and pierced ears. Lee was 13 years old when she went missing. She would be 46 today. If you have any information about the disappearance of Lee Ochey, please contact the Tupelo Police Department at 662-841-6491 or Crime Stoppers of Northeast Mississippi at 1-800-773-TIPS. You can see all the sources for this episode along with photos and videos at our website, andthentheyweregone.com.
And be sure to follow us on social, And Then They Were Gone Pod on Facebook and at ATTWG Pod on Instagram and TikTok. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe and consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It will help new listeners find us. And the more people that listen, the more chances we have of bringing someone home.
And we'll see you here next week for a brand new episode.
See you next week.
And Then They Were Gone is hosted by Kona Gallagher and Ethan Flick. All research, writing, and editing is done by me, Kona Gallagher. Theme music is The Stork by Ketza. Additional music is provided by Kai Engel. And Then They Were Gone is a Little Monster production.
Hey, you can do it!